Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Every presidential election is important, but this year's race had additional pressure. Nearly 80% of us said the future of our country was a source of stress. And now, just about half of all Americans remain anxious. Harris supporters invested in her vision, and a rejection of her felt like a rejection of themselves. On the other hand, Trump supporters say they feel relieved, excited, elated even. The political divide in America right now feels like a chasm, an uncrossable ocean dividing the left from the right. So how do we cross it? Do we cross it? Can we find some scrap of common ground and chart a course forward? Paul Beck is a professor emeritus and academy professor of political science at Ohio State. He's published 9 books and countless articles on voting behavior, political parties, and public opinion. Professor Beck, welcome back to All Sides.
Good to be with you, Anna.
Google searches for how to move to Canada skyrocketed after Trump's victory became apparent. Canada work visa searches went up by 566%. Searches for Project 2025 increased 400%. I think it's safe to say there is a decent chunk of the country who is really anxious right now.
Oh, that's right for sure. I mean, the partisan polarization is as high as it's ever been. I've measured it in public opinion polls since about 1992, and it's grown with every successive year. And I think I don't have data for 2024 yet, although we go into the field with a survey, national survey, in about a week. But in 2024, it's going to be even higher. And it, by the way, it is 60%, over 60% of Democrats and Republicans believe that the other side is really bad and their side is really good. And that comprises almost half of the electorate.
Yeah. Political division may be at its height or the highest point since we started publicly polling on it. But it isn't something new, something that just came about. It's been with us throughout our history.
Oh, yes, for sure. And in fact, if you read about the times in the lead up to the Civil War or in the years afterwards, a great deal of polarization, of divide in the South, not so much in the North, but now it's obviously nationwide, to the point that our choice of friends is very much motivated by our sense of what their partisan stand is.
Yeah, the election of 1800 also comes to mind for me. To go all the way back, that was a very contentious, downright ugly campaign.
Oh, yes. Although my students wouldn't believe this, but I wasn't around then to view it directly. But yes, it was deeply contentious, even between the two candidates for the same party were on the same ticket, Aaron Burr and Thomas Jefferson. They were at loggerheads with each other, and that grew in the following years.
Yeah. My favorite factoid from that election that I've never been able to let go of is that, so it was between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. John Adams was the incumbent. And at one point, the Adams campaign, or surrogates for Adams, spread a rumor that Jefferson had died. And there was no social media. There was no television. There was no telephone. Jefferson literally had to go around to different states and places and reassure people that he was, in fact, not dead and could be voted for.
That's interesting. Well, that's a good factoid to have. Now it would be, of course, amplified through social media.
Yeah. The race was always expected to be close. And I think it was, when you look at a lot of states, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, we still don't have results in Arizona and Nevada, but they're all within a few percentage points.
Yes.
There was no blowout in any of those races, but it was decisive for Trump.
Yes, and in fact, the polls were showing, particularly in the so-called swing states, the 7 that we focused on for electoral college votes, the polls were showing the race to be too close to call in all of those states. Now, I do survey sampling and run surveys, and when I see too close to call, I think it's within the margin of error, so it could go either way. It could be plus or minus 3 or 4 in either direction. But they all broke the same way. in 2024, which was really interesting. And they all broke in favor of Donald Trump.
And they broke in favor of Joe Biden in 2020.
Yes.
They broke in favor of Trump in 2016. I think it's safe to say at this point that we don't know which way the swing states are going to go, but they tend to break together.
Yes. Well, they're composed of the same kinds of populations, and they're very divided in terms of people's partisan loyalties as well, which is why they're swing states.
And in this moment, it can feel impossible that we'll ever find a way to work together. But I do want to play a cut from Vice President Kamala Harris's concession speech at Howard University yesterday, where she said, where she said there was more that unites us than divides us.
I get it. But we must accept the results of this election. Earlier today, I spoke with President-elect Trump and congratulated him on his victory. I also told him that we will help him and his team with their transition, and that we will engage in a peaceful transfer of power.
Paul, that's what you want to hear in this situation.
Yes, that's right. And we didn't hear it 4 years ago, obviously. But it's good to hear it now. I think that one thing Harris wanted to do, and she talked about this during her campaign, was bring Americans together to enlarge the coalition of people who were voting Democratic, even beyond what it had been in 2020. Trump really played to his base. And that strategy proved to be very successful because the base had a high level of turnout, which is what they were hoping for. I think the Democratic base probably, we don't know this yet, we haven't really seen the data yet, but that base may not have turned out at the levels that it turned out in 2020.
Yeah, early results show turnout was down in both Franklin and Cuyahoga counties here in Ohio. So it's still a little early to read those tea leaves, but turnout being down in the Democratic strongholds in Ohio is at least indicative of that theory.
Well, and of course, in Ohio, there was really only one contest that I think voters would have thought mattered, where their vote mattered, and that was the contest for the U.S. Senate. You know, maybe the issue one vote, although that doesn't tend to drive turnout as much as, say, the abortion amendment did a couple of years ago. And so there may have been a lot of voters who said, well, I know Trump's going to win Ohio. I'm a Democrat. And I don't want him to win. But why should I vote? Why should I waste my time?
You know, as somebody who has studied presidential elections and the electorate, I want to ask you a question that I think a lot of Democrats are asking, which is, how did this happen? And I think where I want to start with you is there are certain fundamentals, certain truisms of American politics. And one of is, if a majority of Americans believe the economy is bad and are unhappy with the current president, they do not reelect them.
Yes.
And I feel like that's exactly what happened here.
Well, in fact, it's happened in other countries as well. Being an incumbent used to be an advantage. I think in recent years, it really hasn't been, because incumbents have had to preside over, both in this country and in Europe, massive waves of immigration, which a lot of people in their countries are not happy about. There, of course, was the pandemic. There have been economic problems. The Biden administration was able, at least in the last year of the administration, to have the economy turned around in many ways and moving in the right direction. But there's still that stubborn fact of inflation. And I think sometimes the accounts of inflation and its political impact don't get it quite right, because it doesn't really matter to voters if inflation has come down, as long as the prices stay above what they were 4 years ago. And that certainly proved to be a problem for the Biden administration and, of course, for Kamala Harris.
Yeah, this was an election I think we'll remember as being one where people wanted change. And rightly or wrongly, they saw Harris as being part of the administration. I mean, she literally was.
Yes.
And this looks a lot like, to me, like 1992, like 2008, when the economy feels shaky and people want to try something different.
Well, it's interesting that there have been four presidents in a row, not including this year, where voters have voted for change. Barack Obama was a change agent. back in his first contest, and then really again in his reelection contest. Biden was a change agent in 2020. And then, of course, this year, Trump, what the polls are telling us, and I think they're right, is that many voters saw him as somebody who was going to bring about change from the Biden-Harris administration.
I think that also explains, so, you know, lower-income voters, voters most impacted by grocery prices, broke overwhelmingly for, yes, President Trump, and they started to break across demographic lines. So it wasn't just white working-class voters. It was Black working class voters, Hispanic working class voters. It was a coalition of people who said, you know, I can't afford my groceries anymore.
I think there was a lot of that. Now, I would want to separate Black voters from Hispanics and white voters, because Black voters did vote a little bit more for Trump, but not much more, particularly Black women, but also,
yeah,
Black men. Hispanics broke heavily in the Trump direction from before.
And double-digit change.
Yeah, and you could see this, by the way, when people were reporting, when analysts were reporting on the election results as they came in. And several of the networks and public broadcasting also do these kind of breakdowns by county, in effect. And you could see in Pennsylvania, which was widely regarded as the most important of the battleground states, you could see a bunch of cities and counties in northeastern Pennsylvania where they had a majority of the population that was Hispanic that was breaking for Trump. And then
Miami-Dade County in Florida.
Well, that's a different group of Hispanics.
Yeah.
And a lot of Puerto Ricans there, but also a lot of Cubans and a lot of Hispanics who are refugees from countries that have been taken over by left-wing governments, like in Venezuela, for example. But if you move to the Northeast, there are going to be more Puerto Ricans and maybe Mexican-Americans. Ohio, the predominant Hispanic population, is a Mexican background. Trump ate into those normally Democratic voter blocks, and in a way that was very important for him in his reelection.
You know, I think there's a tendency to look at people who voted for the candidate that you didn't choose and write it off as they just didn't get it. They didn't understand. They're sheep. They're too dumb. They're too this. They're too that. Rather than stepping back and saying, you know, they grew up differently. They have different cultural values, different economic classes, different social issues, different life experiences, family,
yes,
shape. And therefore, they may have looked at the same set of facts and drawn a different conclusion.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that. And it's too bad because it fosters polarization, obviously. The inclination is to believe that your side is all the good and the other side is all the bad. And to kind of project those feelings onto people who are voting on the other side, fairly or unfairly, mostly unfairly. And I think voters vote for a complex of reasons. We ask them in public opinion polls, what's the most important issue motivating you in this election? I've never really believed that those figures were getting at what the essential factor was with them. And of course, a lot of voters don't really know. But you get a sense that I don't like the present administration, and there are things about them that I don't like. There certainly are cultural issues that underlie this. And in fact, one of the biggest divisions, I think, among Americans today is a cultural division, where there are plenty of voters out there who don't like the way things have changed over time. They don't like gay marriage. They don't like abortion, the right to abortion. They don't like immigration, and they, in fact, are inclined to demonize immigrants. We see this in the Springfield debates. So these cultural issues, I think, are very important, but people don't often mention them because they don't see the other culture really as something that is a vote-determining issue. But I think it is, and I think it's important.
Yeah, I also think social media, has really siloed us, and we also self-segregate more now than we ever did. When you look at redistricting, one of the challenges of drawing competitive seats is that we're increasingly self-segregating. We're choosing to be birds of a feather and flock together.
Yes.
And so if you live around people who only believe what you believe, and you interact in social circles and on social media, which algorithms reinforce what you believe by giving you more of it, it can be very hard to think, oh, somebody sees this and calls it differently.
Well, we like to call this an echo chamber effect, where we surround ourselves with people and with media sources that echo our feelings, that reinforce our feelings. We don't really want to hear much from the other side, to the point that we actually will choose our friends based on what we think their partisan proclivities happen to be. And in fact, I've studied that over time, and Americans are more and more inclined to build their friendship networks around people that agree with them politically, or go to churches where people agree with them politically, or for that matter, choose what media they're going to consume, whether they watch Fox News or MSNBC or public broadcasting, for that matter, based on what they think the political proclivity is or the political stance is of that particular media source. In the United States, we've studied this, by the way, in over 60 elections around the world, and the United States is the leader in political polarization, probably second only, and it's almost a tie, to a country that's come into the news recently, and that's Mozambique, which just had an election. The study or the survey we did in Mozambique was 10 years after they had had a very bloody civil war, where the estimate was 500,000 people were either killed or deeply wounded, deeply injured in the civil war. And those feelings really have smoldered over time. So the United States is there. We don't have a civil war yet. I hope we never do again. But, you know, a country like Mozambique holds a lesson to us, where you surround yourself with people who are like you, and you really don't want to be exposed to anything that challenges your own beliefs.
Coming up, we're going to talk about how to manage the emotions you're feeling right now, and we also want to hear from you. How are you handling the results of this election? You can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email your comments to allsides@wosu.org. Your calls and how to manage the way that you're feeling when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. From celebration to despair, Americans are grappling with mixed emotions post-election. The BBC interviewed people across our country about how they're feeling about the results. Here are three women from Florida and North Carolina.
I have family, friends, loved ones that are going to be further marginalized by this, that are already marginalized, and I'm heartbroken.
I'm actually looking forward to it because when he was in the last time, prices went down, we had more money. You know, life was a little better.
I think a lot of us have a lot of anxieties around how the next 4 years might look.
The election results and possibly begin to bridge the political divide. Still with us is Ohio State political scientist emeritus Paul Beck. And joining now is independent licensed social worker Kelly Breidigan. She's also an assistant clinical professor at the College of Social Work at Ohio State. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Breidigan. Excuse me.
Thank you.
I want to ask you, you know, if you believe in a candidate, if you identify with them and they lose, It can feel like the country has rejected part of who you are. How do you begin to navigate that feeling?
I think, you know, obviously something like that that occurs. So this is it's sort of a strange time in that it's a sense of grief, basically, right? So this sense of grief that that kind of overwhelms us. This is a state of vulnerability, in a sense, that's sort of fraught with fear and sadness. And so a lot of people, rather than be in that state of vulnerability, I think what they turn to is anger, which makes them feel powerful. Even if it's not, right? So I think that is a preferred state over that sense of vulnerability. And so, you know, a lot of times when we deal with grief, you know, we struggle. We struggle to manage those emotions. They're very strong and they can be overwhelming, quite honestly.
I think timing is key to any conversation. And right now might be too soon to have a talk with someone who voted differently than you. How do you take time for yourself, I guess, right? Like, you don't have to have a conversation with someone who voted differently than you this week. You can say, you know what, let's circle back in a couple of weeks.
Absolutely, you can. I think it's important, quite honestly, to put some boundaries and some space into this until you get a situation where you feel safe and where you feel that you're able to even have discussions if you want to engage in those. You know, especially if you've identified a hot button topic and, you know, you've talked with this person. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, you know, we need to agree to disagree. And when it comes to politics, you know, simply not talking about that for our relationship and the sake of everyone else, I think is very important. So I think, yeah, absolutely, we have the right to do that.
I want to take a call from Sean in Grove City. Welcome to All Sides, Sean.
Thank you for having me.
So you are a union member and you have some feelings about why other working families chose Trump over Harris. Can you share those?
Yeah, absolutely. I identify, you know, more on the left side of the political spectrum, and listening to my union brothers and sisters talk about why they have voted for Trump. You know, the policies that matter to working families are not the policies that the Democratic Party are currently advancing. Senator Harris had very different policies than Vice President Harris. And I think that's part of the reason why you see 18 million Democrats sitting at home and not turning out for this election. I think if the Democrat Party does a little bit of soul searching and getting back policies that do matter to working class families, getting back to championing Medicare for all, paid family medical leave, you know, getting a little bit more to some planned economics, maybe a negative income tax for our poorest earners. I call it universal basic income, call it, negative income tax if you want the Republicans to like it. But getting to some policies like those that are going to make a difference for the working families that voted for Trump.
You know, Professor Beck, there's always a lot of soul searching that goes on when a party is lost. And there's a lot of hot takes. Some are right. Some are very, very wrong. But it's that moment of reflection, right? Trying to understand why it didn't turn out the way you thought it would.
Yeah, the Democrats are going to be trying to figure out what it was that went wrong. Why, for example, the Biden-Harris administration was so unpopular over almost the full 4 years of their control of the White House. And a lot of recriminations. Do they blame Harris for running a bad campaign? I don't think she did necessarily, but she inherited the mantle from the Biden-Harris administration, which she could never really get beyond. Also, the Democrats have a coalition that is, or a base, I guess I should call it, that has some instability built into it. People who are less inclined to vote in elections, particularly in presidential elections, but in midterms as well. And that's a bit of a problem. And then you have a situation, and I'll come back to something that was said before, and that is that if you have two candidates who are as far apart as Harris and Trump were, or as Trump and Biden were back in 2020, or as Trump and Clinton were back in 2016, it kind of fans the flames of polarization, of bad feeling. And then you feel that if your side doesn't win, oh, woe is me and woe is the country, this is going to be awful. You would feel that in a way that you might not had, let's say, Mitt Romney won the White House back in, you know, some presidential elections ago, or maybe even with Ronald Reagan winning the White House back in 1980. So it depends on the candidates, and some candidates are polarizers, some candidates are not, and try to dampen down that polarization, and that makes it hard to come back together. What we'll see, by the way, in the first days of the Trump administration are attempts to enact a whole series of policies that are really polarizing policies, and how people will get through that period and try to kind of tone down their own feelings about what is going on in Washington will be an interesting question.
Yeah, we still don't know who will control the U.S. House of Representatives. That will have a big impact on how a Trump administration will be able to govern. But
yes.
Professor Breitigan, a lot of folks feel very anxious. You know, Trump has had verbally attacked his opponents, made outrageous statements about shooting Liz Cheney or going after Adam Schiff or any kinds of questions. How do people navigate those anxious, unsettled, can't sleep at night feelings?
Yeah. So I think part of this really is, at least for right now, since things are so raw, and like I said, grief is such a major emotion that we're experiencing, I think it's really important that we kind of set boundaries or limits on how much political content we consume. I think limiting news maybe to once a day, and then once we've caught up on the main points that we're trying to learn about, move on. You know, try to go find something else during your day that you need to do or put your energy into. This also includes, I think, monitoring our time on social media, at least initially. You know, part of this is that the algorithms are set up in a way that it's going to give information, especially if we consume a lot of the political content, that's what we're going to receive. I think also focusing on areas that we can control instead of what might happen. We don't have any way of knowing exactly what's going to happen. And so if our mind goes to worst case scenario, that's just going to increase that anxiety, right? So, you know, really think about things that you've done in the past to cope with uncertain times or similar situations. Our past behaviors are often, tools that we can use to really understand how we've been successful. Also engaging in things like, you know, healthy habits to deal with stress and decrease anxiety. Things like, you know, simple breathing exercises to slow the heart rate, lower the blood pressure. Also progressive muscle relaxation is another good one where you tense and relax muscles. You can find guides for this online all over the place. Listen to calming music, right? This will decrease stress and sort of calm our central nervous system. But one that I think gets overlooked quite a lot is physical activity. Physical activity is one of those things that increases those feel-good sort of neuromessengers that we have, and it improves mood and can provide distraction. So I think in the self-care realm, really paying attention to that is going to be important. I would also say, finally, the connection with support systems, family and friends that understand what we're going through right now. Obviously having topics that we don't necessarily constantly talk about politics, but having those around us that we know and know us can be incredibly supportive. We're social beings, right? So we can get real support from that.
For those who are happy, excited, even elated with how the election turned out, I want to talk about how they can share that, but also how not to be, I guess, a sore winner. Sometimes so much of what I see, you know, you saw it in 2020 when Biden won, in 2016 when Trump won, people almost wanting to dunk on the guys that lost. And I don't know that that's helpful.
Yeah, I don't think that it is, quite honestly. And I think it's really important. And I think for both sides, really, to be respectful of our friends and family and coworkers, even if we don't agree with them. You know, everybody has a right to their own opinions. I think, you know, really, when we look at it, people rarely change their deeply held convictions, you know, over some sort of squabble. It just doesn't happen. And that's because most people feel that they have chosen the right political position for themselves. These choices are often based on their lived experience, their worldview. And so if we're not changing each other's minds, what we can do is respect one another's right to have a position, right? Even if it disagrees with our own. One of the things I always try to get my students in particular to do is as we're working toward, you know, learning psychotherapy is really to listen to understand rather than convince others to change. If I'm really trying to understand how someone thinks, it doesn't mean it's going to change my view, but I can at least understand where they're coming from. We look for common beliefs, or we look for areas of agreement. And if you take that position of curiosity, where you're just trying to learn about and understand where they're coming from, I think it helps us avoid responding in critical ways.
I want to take a call from Bernie in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. My concern is that how can we reconcile these differences when we can't even agree upon definitions or interpretations of certain words? I mean, there are times when we seem further and further apart because we don't share the same definition.
You know, Paul, that is particularly when it, I think that's true. And we also got an email from Eric that kind of backs this up, who said, you know, he feels like our discussion is missing, that there's a lot of people in this country who he believes despise minorities, or at least fine with their disenfranchisement. When we have such different definitions, say, for who is an American, how do we move forward together?
Well, that's a problem. Our leaders obviously play a role in what we think about what's going on politically. And our leaders have been very polarized themselves. We see this in the Congress. They can't seem to agree on much of anything. Even a budget for the current year is a challenge for them.
The farm bill.
I mean, you could just cite a whole series of examples of this. And it means that things that are real problems that we need to be able to address just don't get addressed, because one side is going to blame the other side for how they are addressed, rather than coming to some kind of a meeting of mind, some kind of a compromise on these issues. The points Kelly was making were really good points, I think, about trying to just kind of tone down the politics in your world, pay attention to other things. I live in a retirement community, and we have speakers every week. And the speaker we had last night was a comedian who had a real sense of humor, didn't say anything at all about politics. And that was actually the right speaker to have on the day after the election.
Kelly, I want to ask about the upcoming holiday season, because whether your candidate won or your candidate lost, you may be inwardly dreading being around extended family who don't believe the way that you do. First and foremost, I think, should we give ourselves permission to stay away? Or if we do go, how do we navigate that?
But I think it's going to be essential in some ways, especially with some families, to separate politics from the person, right? It always sounds much easier than it actually is. But I think, you know, politics should not divide people who share rich histories and care about each other. You love the same people. You're there to support one another, right? So the main reason that this is hard, I think, is because a lot of times we think that a person's political beliefs are expressions of their moral character. And, you know, if we really think about it, it's sort of that idea that this horrible political belief system, then the person themselves has to be horrible. And really that the research doesn't really back that up. University of Nebraska just came out with some research that actually found that people often have standards of moral behavior in their own personal lives that that when making choices related to their political candidates and parties don't align. And so, you know, I think separate that from the person, separate those political beliefs from the person, and really embrace sort of, you know, how you have connected with this person over time. I also think it's going to take time. You need to take the time to respond thoughtfully, right? You know, if somebody says something, especially if we perceive it to be threatening or insensitive, I think that, you know, we have to remember that these relationships are important to us and that there's a lot at stake. It's not just you and that person, but your entire, you know, family could have issues with how an argument or disagreement may go. And so I think it's important, you know, this isn't just a stranger on social media in that way. So again, if the person does something that is hurtful or says something that you feel like is hurtful, there's nothing wrong with taking a breath and counting to 10 in your head, right? Slow down that threat response so that we aren't necessarily having the discussion that is full of stress and reactive sort of emotions and things like that. Really try and give it that time so that that prefrontal area that can control those sort of conversations that are more thoughtful and reasonable would be important. I also think that if we're angry, we're going to have an issue, right? So again, if those emotions get triggered, you know, pay attention to your body language, your emotions, the same thing with the person that you're talking to. You know, so if you notice, you know, mannerisms getting sort of wild, or you have body cues that are indicating that, you know, you've got sweaty palms, or you're breathing, you know, more quickly, things like that, excuse yourself. You know, you can easily say, sorry, hang on just a sec, I got to go make a phone call, or I need to go to the restroom. And again, it puts that distance for us so that we don't say something that we regret or damage relationships.
I, by the way, think that's important on both sides. Both the winners need to refrain from engaging in excessive celebration of the win, and the losers need to engage in less remorse and, you know, less attacking the winner as somebody who really should not have won. I think of a sports analogy here, and that is that in football, people who are players who celebrate a touchdown or a great play sometimes are penalized by the officials for celebration. That is an actual penalty area. And I think it's probably important to realize that if you are lording over the opponent because you've broken up a pass or you've intercepted a pass, you're just kind of rubbing it in. And if you can back away from that, I think we're probably all better off, both as viewers but also as players on the field.
Coming up, the future of election integrity and the peaceful transfer of power. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Vice President Kamala Harris has conceded that she lost the election and promised a peaceful transfer of power. It's a decidedly different tone than the one struck by former President Donald Trump when he lost the 2020 election. Still with us is Ohio State political scientist Professor Emeritus Paul Beck, social worker Kelly Breitigan, who is also an assistant clinical professor in the College of Social Work at OSU, and joining us now is Kara Ong Whaley, Vice President of Election Protection at the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Issue One. And no, it has nothing to do with our Issue One. Welcome to All Sides, Kara.
Thank you so much for having me. Good to be with you all this morning, Anna.
Kara, misinformation is already swirling around whether Democrats will certify the election. A fake tweet is circulating by Representative Jamie Raskin saying Trump will not set foot in the White House again. I want to be clear, that's not true. Raskin says the quote is 100% made up, and he will not object to the election results. But how do we handle the misinformation that continues post-election?
We have seen a barrage of misinformation, disinformation, and propaganda this entire election season, and we do not expect it to let up between now and Election Day. There are both foreign and domestic actors that have been flooding our information ecosystem, intent on sowing further divisions within our electorate that exist. What we have been saying, it is impossible to combat every piece of false information that arises. So what we have been focused on this year, along with partner organizations at the state, national and local level, is really trying to focus on good, credible information. So that is the best thing that we can do, is to reaffirm good information and where to get good sources of information. If it's about elections, it's best to go to local officials who, by the way, are still counting votes at this moment and still working tirelessly, even though the last day of voting has passed.
I want to take a call from Greg in Columbus, who seems to have some concerns about this particular kind of issue. Welcome to All Sides, Greg.
Hey, thank you for having me, Anna. You know, when I listened to Kamala's concession speech yesterday, I was reminded about the speech that Trump never gave. Rather, he gave a pep rally to those who ended up attacking our Capitol on January 6th. Jump forward to this past March, and when he comes to Ohio to endorse Bernie Moreno and asks everyone in the audience to stand and honor these people as heroes, and he promises to pardon them on day one. Jim Jordan, J.D. Vance, Moreno all stood to honor these people and have never since denounced the thought of pardoning them. I've called DeWine's office multiple times since then, and he won't denounce the idea of releasing convicted felons into our communities. It's just a downright shame.
You know, Kara, it's difficult to navigate those kinds of questions, particularly surrounding what happened and what people were afraid of if the election had gone a different way.
Absolutely. Going into the election, we had done a lot of research, survey research, probing Americans' views and attitudes on this. And one of the things that we saw was that Republicans were less confident in the process. And so one of the things we had focused on, especially to counter the false claims and beliefs in the false claims that were perpetuated by the former and now future president about the 2020 election. So a lot of our work actually centered on focusing on how our elections are free and fair. And I think that's something that we need to continue to do. Our elections are administered at the local level by people from our communities. Of course, we will continue to deal with the aftermath of false claims of the 2020 election. And I think something that we've seen in other countries is that those with inclinations towards authoritarianism will continue to make false claims about election processes. The best way to counter that is to get involved ourselves, to get information from credible sources, and to continue to participate actively in the election processes. And also to remember that elections are just one form of democratic practice, and there are other ways to be involved in our democracy. And finally, and that includes holding election officials accountable.
Professor Bridingen, how do we navigate those kinds of conversations when you have a family member who may believe in a conspiracy theory?
Yeah, so I think it's incredibly important in many ways that you know, there are times that it's sometimes better not to respond. You know, as they're sort of having their conversation about whatever this is, when they're lost in that conspiracy ideology, sometimes I think that obviously they believe it to be true. There's something about it that's threatening, and so they're holding on to that information because they themselves are scared or worried about some specific thing, and so I think in some cases it might be best not to respond, you know, just because you could get angry or you could further that conversation with it, you know, particularly. But I think it's also really important as we're having this conversation, we have to remember that people have very different ways of managing uncertainty. And so one of those is that, you know, some people tend to hold on to everything and they want to return to life as how it was before. They seek comfort and, you know, have a sense of stability and familiarity with the past during difficult times, while others want to get rid of painful past and start over. And so they're really focused on that future and removing physical reminders of loss and start to rebuild their lives with a future focus. And so it doesn't mean that there's a right or wrong way to do it. It just means it's very different. And so oftentimes I think when we're sort of affronted with someone who has a very different system in the way that they manage uncertainty, it can be very off-putting because we don't understand it. It's just simply not the way that we may do things. So, you know, really, really focusing in on that and recognizing that is definitely going to be an area where folks will struggle a bit with one another.
Paul, trust in institutions, trust in government, in media, in Congress, in the judicial system, in electoral security are all in the toilet.
Yes.
Some of the lowest ever since we started polling.
Yes.
Big picture, super difficult question. Paul, how do we fix that?
Well, I think by maintaining integrity of the electoral process itself. There's been a lot of work to try to promote that integrity since the 2000 election. One of the interesting consequences of the result in 2024 is that we will hear less rhetoric challenging the electoral process itself. That wouldn't have been true had Trump not won or had the election been closer than it turned out to be. That may be a really positive thing. And we will see going forward how positive that is. But I think we're not going to hear from President-elect Trump that there was something really wrong with the electoral process and that he was cheated in one way or another. He won. And he won decisively, and my hope is that he will take that to the bank and move on.
Kara, do you think we'll see less questions about this election, or are we going to be right back where we were in 2028? Like, are these people who believe elections are being stolen and there's mass voter fraud, do you think they're going to go away, or do you think we're going to be right back where we were?
It's really hard to make predictions, but I think that we need to be on guard for continued false information circulating. Again, in other countries, we've seen that even when some leaders are elected, they continue to spread false information and claims of fraud. In fact, we saw that happen previously in 2017 after the former president was elected. And then we only saw it amplified and exacerbated after 2020 when former President Trump, President-elect Trump, did lose. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of the false information we saw circulating in the narratives, we saw that we're at a fever pitch this election cycle, are not going away, particularly in regards to false claims about non-citizens voting. And in fact, we see a number of state legislatures introducing legislation on that issue. So I think I certainly hope that it goes away. But I think that we have a lot of work to do to improve our institutions, to continuously improve our institutions, to make sure that they are responsive to people's needs, and to also be more inclusive of making sure that people can participate in our institutions so they can understand and have a better appreciation for how they work.
Professor Breitigan, we talked a little bit about the holidays, about managing this kind of stuff going forward. One of the things that you talk about that I find particularly interesting is taking a position of curiosity in our conversations. Can you give us examples of like what that might look like going forward? How do we take a position of curiosity when emotions are still so high?
So that's part of the key, right? Is that if my emotions are really high, I'm not operating from the center of the brain that's in a solid logical space. And if my emotions are set up in a way that I sense threat, what it's going to do, quite honestly, is it's not even going to allow me to access kind of that logical part of myself. And so I think what's important with that, rather than be on the defensive or something along those lines, again, taking in that information, being aware of my own emotions and how I'm kind of responding to whatever's going on physically. But I also think the position of curiosity is incredibly important because you're just trying to understand, right? So when I'm asking questions to someone, there are many times in psychotherapy when you're working with a client and they have a very different view than yours. And so it's not my job to change their mind. It's simply my job to understand where they're coming from and why that's the position they're taking. And so engaging in things that are non-threatening. So, if somebody says, here's the reason why I voted for whatever party that I voted for and why they're right and why, I feel that the other party's wrong, then you can say, how did you come to find out more? How did you come to believe that is how that goes? Help me understand the specific things that have been helpful to you to understand the belief systems behind that specific candidate or that party. And in many ways, when we really begin to get in to understand, what we find is that Both sides often are less extreme than they actually are, especially when we're talking about family and friends, right? We come from oftentimes similar value systems or belief systems in some way. And so we can find that common ground. We're viewing ourselves in some ways also as more rational, and the other side is more irrational. And if we can go into that and not have those blind spots, right? Just that awareness that the person has the right to that view system, and that you know this person, you know who they are and where some of these ideas have come from. Also, I think we have to really watch the idea that we align with in-group, that it's been very beneficial for our survival, the group that's just like us and believes like us. But unfortunately, that allegiance can lead to also the out-group, right? So isolation.
Unfortunately, we've got to leave it there. That was Kelly Breitigan, a licensed social worker and assistant professor at Ohio State. Thank you so much. And thank you to OSU Professor Emeritus Paul Beck and Kara Ong Watley, Vice President of Election Protection at the nonprofit Issue One.